Let me make my business plain. I have no interest in Septimus's woes, Harrow said. The Seventh House is not our friend. You're making yourself an utter fool over Dulcinea, and I dislike her cavalier even more. Massive slam on Protesilea's out of nowhere, said Gideon. But I would finish the challenge that sickened Sexus. Not for the high ground, but because he must learn to stare these things in the face. Do you know what I'd have to do?
Yeah, said Gideon. You're going to suck out my life energy in order to get to the box on the other side.
A ham-fisted summary, but yes. How did you come to that conclusion?
Because it's something Palamedes wouldn't do, she said. And he's a perfect moron over Camilla the Sixth.
Okay.
What do you mean, okay?
I mean, okay, I'll do it, said Gideon. Although most of her brain was trying to give the part of her brain saying that a nipple gripple. She chewed at a damp fleck of lip paint and took off her dark glasses, then popped them into her pocket. Now she could look Harrow dead in the eye.
I'd rather be your battery than feel you rummaging around in my head.
You want my juice? I'll give you juice. Under no circumstances will I ever desire your juice.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief. Episode 20. Avulsion!
With an exclamation point.
I'm thrilled to welcome back. You may recognize her from cover art. Dulcinea is once back in the room, creepy with us. Harrow, and we are so excited to have you here to talk about this very information-rich chapter and what is the longest chapter in the book so far.
Yeah.
Yay. Yes, thank you. You can't get rid of me. I'm so excited.
Oh, no.
What is it about this chapter specifically that was really important to you to come back and talk with us about again?
I think just the description of the Avulsion test from Gideon's perspective, I feel like is like so, from a like writing perspective, so well done, in my opinion, and so like evocative and just like visceral. And I'm really impressed by it. And also like, fascinated by all the interpersonal stuff that it reveals and all the like relational stuff that it reveals. And yes, it's just a very interesting, meaty chapter, you know? There's a lot going on.
At the very beginning of this chapter, Harrow paints Gideon's face, which isn't how they normally do things. And Gideon just lets it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an inversion of the first time Harrow painted her face, and it's this tenderness and intimacy, but it's also real awkward. Like, what a moment.
Yeah, it's such an interesting, like she's really kind of taking care of Gideon in a way, both at the beginning and the end of this,
mm-hmm.
which is not their usual relationship at all. But just in very different ways.
Now, we've talked a lot about agency and instrumentalization of the body and their relationship. And there is a tenderness there. But I think there's also a little bit of a sinisterness of like Harrow realizing that she needs Gideon to do what Harrow's goals require to complete. Like Gideon is still, her body is still being treated the way it is in service to Harrow's priorities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like this tenderness, this care is because Harrow realizes that losing Gideon means she will not become a lictor. She doesn't understand exactly why, mm-hmm. but it has occurred to her that she actually really does need Gideon. You know, maybe it was in the room with the key with the dots and the curves that we haven't figured the symbol of. Like there's ways in which Harrow's come to this conclusion. But it's not like Harrow has suddenly decided that Gideon has real agency that she wants to respect.
Do we think that that is slightly less true at the end? Because I think Harrow probably does pretty genuinely feel pretty bad about Gideon almost dying there at the, or maybe dying there at the end. And maybe that's a little bit more genuine of a taking care of response. But I don't know.
You know, in the last few chapters, as the two of them have encountered these other models of cavalier-necro relationships, they have been getting a little bit experimental. And part of that experimenting has been Harrow treating Gideon with more respect and honoring her agency more. And in this chapter, she promises Gideon 8.5 hours of sleep and gives her 8 hours and 25 minutes just sort of to be a bitch.
Because she always lies.
But she is not, she is asking to do this. She sort of almost doesn't ask, but Gideon understands that she is asking. She says, like, I need to lean on your trust. But Gideon has the opportunity to say no to her here. And that's a big shift in their dynamic. She absolutely can't do it without Gideon. And she gives Gideon the opportunity not to consent to this because of what a horrifying thing she's asking.
And she seems genuinely pretty surprised that she did agree to it.
Yeah. The appearance of Dulcinea in the facility here is once again a bit unhinged if you stop and think about it. This is the first time that she presents with the crutches. And like that immediately raises the question, how does she get down the staple ladder with crutches?
I would assume that Pro could carry her down the ladder.
Yeah, I guess that's
true. He's big and beefy.
He could totally do that.
Yeah. Because Gideon could carry Harrow up it.
Backpack where he keeps his necromancer. Backpack where he keeps his necromancer.
He's got like a baby Bjorn.
Yeah.
A Duchess Bjorn.
Very distinguished.
But she says that she has come into the facility in order to talk to Harrow. And it seems like going to Harrow's room would be an easier way to catch Harrow than going into the spider-webbed facility at random and happening to catch her. Like, the fact that she goes, ah, I've come here to speak with you, and Harrow is like, yeah, that makes... I'm like, what?
Okay, so my thought on this was it specifically calls out that she kind of seems to be feeling worse than usual, like her hands were shaking and everything. I'm wondering if she was down there trying to do it herself and failing. And then they came down and she was like, oh, hey.
I'll also the counterpoint, like, it's not easy to find Harrow at her chambers.
True.
She lives there and can't fucking find Harrow.
No, that's true. I love Dulcinea's little description here of her interest in the ghosts. And I want to posit that maybe Kithareya has actually been fucking around in the basement because she's curious about the evil ghost. She's like, while I'm here.
That seems very possible to me.
I want that.
That seems like something she would enjoy and be interested in.
And it's also something that she could weaponize against John should she figure out how to master it.
Yeah. Big time.
This is a cool side quest, I think.
Yeah. Also, I enjoyed that, which, you know, Dulcie making the wards that would just tell her information about the ghosties and stuff down there rather than, like, stop them. Mm-hmm. Like, her explanation was, like, I want to see what's coming. But that does kind of, that contributes to the theory that she was looking for it. But that stood out to me because they just, like, really casually gave Cytherea, the evil lictor, their blood. And that moment for me was like, oh god, don't do that. Who knows what she can do with that?
And honestly, the fact that Harrow didn't even fucking pause.
Yeah.
She did it, yeah.
Instantly. Like, it made her feel better.
So bad. A, Harrow wants it so bad. And B, like, she now believes that for some reason she has to work with Septimus. It's Harrow doesn't work with people unless she thinks she has to.
I feel like Harrow's also the type of person that once she commits to something, she's like 100% in. Like, yes. She's made the decision, so like, whatever it takes.
There is no rudder on that thing. It goes straight ahead.
Yeah.
The whole bit where Dulcie is talking about, like, she's really curious about Palamides and she'd like to get to know him better, and Harrow knows him better than she does, is so brutal.
It's so brutal.
Kithareya's lack of a thorough dossier on Palamides and Dulcie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really do. I think that that's something that Dulcinea probably did on purpose. And I think it's a shame that other people didn't know that they were close.
Yeah.
Because if they did, she would have just been like instantly...
completely skeptical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that Palamedes probably knows at this point that something's weird. And he's like not able to really articulate that to anybody in any way.
Mm-hmm. Because he can't prove it.
Weird position to be in for our boy.
Yeah, I wonder how long it took him to get out of jiltedness and realize that that wasn't actually why she was ignoring him.
Yeah. Because on a personal level, you're in your early 20s and this happens to you. You are assuming that you're the problem. You're assuming it's about your relationship. Like,
yeah,
fully. Well,
a significantly older woman who turns down my marriage proposal ignores me at party. Like, that doesn't take a deeper analysis.
Until other weird things start to happen.
But then and it's like...
For a while after that, probably.
But then Protesilaus isn't behaving appropriately. Mm-hmm. And he's got it... Like, that's got to be part of the clue for him, is Protesilaus is warm and genial and fatherly towards Dulcinea and creative and, you know, like... And then he's just a Ken doll. He's got to be like, what's happening with that?
Protesilaus on reread is like really unsettling and weird. And that's another thing that I like didn't really pick up on initially. But like, he's acting very strangely.
It's practically on billboards. He's an undead puppet guy. And you this just don't notice.
Yeah. You've got a lot of other stuff to think about, to be fair. Okay, do we know whose test this is? I don't keep track of stuff like that.
It's Mercy's.
Oh, God. Of course it is. I should have known. Okay, so presumably Mercy called it diversion and Loveday called it avulsion.
Yeah.
Exclamation point.
So an avulsion injury refers to a situation where a part of the body is suddenly torn away from the rest of the body. If you're familiar with degloving is a type of avulsion injury. You can also have bone avulsions, most often in athletes. You can also have dental avulsions and sometimes tendons or nerves can have avulsion injuries. It is a real bad fucking injury.
Yeah, so do we think, so the difference between diversion and avulsion is kind of just the violence of it, I feel
like? Yeah, diversion is a story about the movement of thanergy through space, and avulsion is a story about what it's like to have it happen to you.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, there you go, Loveday's the one that renamed it. One thing that really struck me after reading this just horrifying description of this happening is there's no way that nobody died doing this. There's no way that everybody that did this survived. Like, how many calves and necros do you think were churned through in the effort to get those first, like so many?
How is this survivable for anyone on any attempt?
Yeah.
And I guess that starts to answer the question of, like, the time between, like, John's ascension and the resurrection and the different ascensions of the different lictors. Like, it was during that period of time, over time, that these people were churned through. And only after a great deal of experimentation, which would involve years of training for the individuals leading up to it. And, like, if it's only the people of the house, like, are we only testing it on the heads of the houses?
I think originally. I think that was just this batch, is at least my understanding. But I don't know how he was choosing people.
It seems like they made these the tests after they became lictors to explain how to become a lictor.
Yeah. Okay, because that first generation, it seems like he had 100% success rate, unless he was just leaving some dead friends out of his stories.
So we figured this out a couple of episodes ago, I think last episode with Kit. Kit explained this to us. The generations don't work like that. So the first generation of lictors were pre-resurrection friends, but they weren't lictors yet. And the second generation of lictors were post-resurrection friends, but they weren't, they all became lictors together.
Okay. So he just made them immortal. He didn't make them lictors. And then they figured out the, okay.
Yeah, okay, I had this wrong in my head, but everybody became a lictor at the same time.
Okay. I've just realized that Loveday was Cytherea's cavalier and not Mercy's. I was saying that wrong.
Yeah, Christabel.
Oops. Take away my card.
Mine too. how do I not know that?
I said it with such conviction.
You did. And I was like, yeah, okay.
You guys say that, and I'm over here being like, I don't even know the names of all the cavaliers. Like, I don't even fucking know what you're talking about. Like, I, in some ways, like, don't retain enough of this to be able to hold those layers of readings in this and realize that that puts me in a situation where, like, I incidentally erase, dehumanize, don't recognize the sacrifice of these cavaliers because I, as a reader, am not remembering their names. I'm not remembering their relationships. I'm not remembering how they fit into this story. So as I'm reading this, I remember the lictors. But, like, there are so many names to retain. And, like, this is kind of an interesting mechanism of the way this, like, dramatis personae works. It's so big. We see the central players of this story, but, like, we experience the erasure of the others. Eonthe kind of makes it clear that, like, she doesn't need Babs in the same way that Harrow might perceive that she needs Gideon. Like, you know, Eonthe has solved some of the other problems more on a theoretical basis. And I would imagine Harrow maybe might have picked up on that. And if Gideon had said no, Harrow still would have found a way to solve the puzzle. But she did want Gideon to, she did want a real yes. She's willing to see that there's more than one path and that which path is taken, Gideon, is a determining factor.
And interestingly, in asking for a real yes, she is, in this moment, giving Gideon more agency than Palamedes gives Camilla.
True.
Because Pal is saying no on her behalf, which isn't giving her agency, because Cam probably would do it.
She would, and that's rough.
And that may even be why he, like, there is another angle of, like, he may understand that she would, and he doesn't want her to, so he is saying no on her behalf.
Yeah.
Both in terms of not giving her agency, but also using his position to do so without really having that being questioned by her in a protective manner.
Maybe he is not saying no on her behalf. Like, Gideon assumes that he would say no on her behalf. He might be saying no on his own behalf, that he doesn't want to be the person who does this to her.
True. And, you know, Harrow, like, even if she wasn't to the point where she actually wanted Gideon's full enthusiastic consent for, like, ethical reasons, she does need it because, as we find out, Gideon could have stopped this at any time and just let her die, which is pretty wild to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gideon kind of has the power in the situation in a way, which is interesting.
She does.
Yeah. And it is interesting how that becomes a balancing factor in terms of power dynamics within this world. Like, you know, in so many ways, the necro-cav relationship isn't one of, like, a real balance and agency, but in the ascent to lictorhood, these things are tested and have to be rebalanced. And this is, like, our first, I think.
Mercy was making sure that it was consensual.
Ooh.
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 Mercy put a consent gate on it so that you couldn't become a lictor without your cavalier being on board. That your cavalier had a gun to your head at least once during the process.
Oh, shit. And that, yeah, that makes sense.
And of course, it would have to be taking things to the absolute limit.
Uh-huh.
To do so.
Oof.
This is a message that I think more than anything, the cavalier learns an important lesson here. The necromancer doesn't learn the lesson out of this test. The cavalier learns it hurts the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to. I found it really interesting that when Hera is explaining to Gideon why they need to do this, the reason that she gives is that Palamedes needs to learn to confront things like this. And the sense of the sort of like, that's a bad reason to do this. And also it indicates a level of investment in what Palamedes is and is doing that is really surprising because, yeah, she has been treating this as like, I have to team up with him because that's what I have to do. But she is interested in his moral development in what is presented in a way that's like super fucked up. But the fact that she's interested in it at all is that's a big change.
And it's no longer adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
Like she is in some ways feeling like she has to take responsibility to mold the direction that Palamedes is going, but in a way that doesn't involve actually collaborating or dialoguing directly with any sort of mutual respect.
She's really offended that he isn't willing to get his hands dirty to the degree that she is. And it's interesting viewing this as an 18-year-old adultified child interacting with an older young adult. There's a lot happening here where she is confronting the things that she has had to do and the things that she knows that she will continue to have to do. And she's furious at the idea of an older person who's not willing to get as dirty as she is. Mm-hmm. And she's like he needs to grow up.
I feel like a lot of this is her kind of defending her own fucked up belief system rather than considering that maybe it's a little fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a thing that people do for sure. That's very realistic, actually.
Extremely realistic. And the idea of looking at another person and saying, I need to almost kill you to teach that guy a lesson. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
That to me is extremely ninth. That feels like that is how she was taught things probably when she was younger. Like, let's make this person suffer in order to demonstrate a lesson. Like, that just feels like something that would have happened to her. And now she's perpetuating.
I mean, sure. That's what Gideon's for.
Yeah, exactly. Gideon's a tool.
To almost die to teach someone a lesson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is another thing that seems important to me, but I don't know what to do with it in my filing cabinet brain of TLT things, that you can't move Thanergy from one place to another. That seems interesting to me. You can only move Thalergy, which is you can't move the death energy. You can only move the life energy.
I'm glad that you brought this up because it's fucking solid of Hera to be like, you're the one who wants me to do this. Why don't I siphon you? Mm-hmm. I think that's cool. I think that's a violation of the power structure in a way that like is neat. You're the one who wants this. I'm the one who wants this. You and I should be the ones who make this happen. And Dulcinea is obviously like, oh, you can't find out what's in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so she needs...
like, oh, I'm so weak. Oh, no. No life energy.
But the explanation she gives doesn't explain exactly... I guess Gideon has a lot of Thalergy?
She certainly does. I think, okay, yes, so does. My theory is that's going to end up being like what Gideon's whole deal is in terms of her like superpowers is that she's like extra
just thalergetic.
Yeah, like she's got extra life energy. Mm. So I think that's maybe the only reason why the test worked. I don't know.
I don't think that another Necromancer Cav pair could have succeeded at this test.
Me neither.
There's ambiguity about the pre-resurrection because of the name redaction. We don't know 100% that these are the people that we hear about. But the context on the person who made this puzzle. It seems like Ed is Mercy, but we don't actually know who Christabel Mercy's Cavalier is. Pre-resurrection has a really, really close relationship with a person who has no name, no initial, who is a nun, which helps us understand the eighth religious orientation. They were both Catholic, I believe. No, M was atheist, but they had this incredibly close relationship. M's nun is part of how John figured out that the soul is important to resurrection. she was the source of a lot of the key theoretical information for John figuring out how to do what he did to everyone. And her death was really important as well.
And her willingness in that to like sacrifice and suffer for the cause, I feel like sort of makes sense for the horrible avulsion test sort of thing. Like, I feel like that translates. It's also a little bit Catholic. Yes.
As someone who is still a recovering Catholic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And John really horribly wasted her death. She sacrificed herself for John's knowledge, and he just watched it happen and learned from watching it happen. But he didn't capture the soul when it left her body. He just watched it leave.
Do you think he could have become a lictor with her?
He could have.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And he just sort of... I mean, we're seeing this through John explaining it to Harrow in... He could be lying. We don't know. But what we have been shown, and then she gets resurrected and sacrifices her life again for Mercy to become a lictor. And so the thing that we know about the Cavalier who went into this puzzle is that she was willing to die for this twice.
Mm-hmm.
I have had the sensation of like fully embodied religious faith. I don't carry that in my body these days, but it is an astonishing experience that leads to a kind of confidence that is incomparable, in my opinion. Like, I'm imagining Christabel dying the first time and then being resurrected and being like, I was fucking right. Like, like there's a part of her that like this conviction that she deeply felt that was not really held by a lot of her peers at this point. Like, it was really validating in some ways, but also knowing the kind of suffering that is part of the sacrifice and choice that she was making. Like, there's both the belief, which like, you know, the confirmation of what she knew, but then there's the very personal, like, personality, temperament, values, individual choice that the cause was worthwhile. Because the cause was not what was her belief. Like, mm-hmm. her belief was about the metaphysical reality of the world. The cause was her individual values as a person.
And what's interesting is that Augustine describes her as a total delight, effervescent, kind to animals and children, a master of the sword, did not have the intellect you'd ordinarily find in a sandwich.
Oh, that's so charming.
So she is remembered as this incredibly sweet person who is both a hardline fanatic and like kind of a dummy.
Feels kind of naive, I guess.
They don't remember her as a genius who helped John one-on-one unlock resurrection, which is how John remembers her. They remember her as a really pleasant idiot. But she and Alfred, who was the Cavalier to Augustine, basically invented the Cavalier role together. And there's some suggestion that Augustine and Christabel understood what needed to happen for lictorhood to happen. And Augustine and Mercy Morn weren't willing to do it. And so they forced their hands.
So we don't, I feel like, get much of an indication that John was like a particularly religious person pre everything. Thing going down, and I wonder if Christabel might have been more of an influence on like the very religious-y culture of the Empire than one might think.
Yeah.
I do think he went to Catholic school or something.
Okay, so he knew all of it.
Yeah, I think he knew it, and I think he like had feelings about nuns.
The, you know, talking back to the avulsion, that this is a consent test by Mercy Morn, the fact that maybe she was forced into this process would make even more sense that she would, in, you know, distilling and crystallizing this knowledge into a test that can reproduce these skills and this knowledge. Absolutely. She'd be like, well, they fucked me over and I'm not going to let them do it to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And she gives that energy off a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both the necromancer and the Cavalier have to really want to get through this project.
Yeah. And be like very capable. I feel like you could very easily be a true believer and be all in and just not be capable enough to do it. Like, these are very difficult tests.
Yeah, I think that we come back to, is this actually a solvable puzzle? Because Gideon is not a normal girl.
And nobody else does this one, do they?
Not to our knowledge.
Yeah. I don't know how anybody else could.
Pal doesn't think anybody else could.
So if, and that even further reinforces the idea that this is by Mercy Morn's design. If that's the case, then she's basically saying no one's going to get through.
Which I would buy. I would totally buy that she would do that.
She's built in a fail.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And sabotage the process.
Broke it.
It's possible that this was sort of the earliest rebellion from Mercy Morn. Mm-hmm. I've built a very cool puzzle that will kill anyone willing to solve it.
Yep.
That's very Mercy Morn energy.
One of those, if you want it this bad, you shouldn't have it sort of situations.
If you're willing to do what it takes to open this box, I am going to burn you alive.
Yep. Fair, honestly. Speaking of, the description that we get of how the eighth siphoning works in juxtaposition to how the avulsion thing works, mm-hmm. finally unlocked for me what the fuck happens with Colum at the end. Like, I'd never understood it before, and I was like, oh, it leaves an empty space, and then it went into the empty space. I was like, thank you. That always confused me so much.
Yeah. Yeah. When teacher talks about emptying him in previous chapters, I had assumed it meant draining him, like emptying him of his stuff. No, the soul is just like ditched, just like
go over there.
It's like getting a vacuum and then putting a turbine on the thing that can refill that vacuum.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very good, yeah.
Which is so, I mean, talk about it, instrumentalizing the body. Let's just kick the person out of this.
But yeah, the second house thing is scary.
Yeah, every time somebody baby girlifies Judith, I'm like, hard out for me. I know that they're all gray and they're all fucked up, and that's, but I can't do that one.
She's so scary.
I had forgotten that the reason that Judith was pushing people's souls out of their body and stealing Thanergy through them was to beef up Marta. And mm-hmm. that is even grosser. And the fact that Gideon's response to it is first rad and then, oh, they're creeps, is like so real in her dysfunctional ideology. Like, she finds it gross, but she also wants to have it done to her.
It very much feels like a comic book superpower, too.
It does.
So that kind of makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. She's probably heard of that.
Herself, like, with even bigger muscles while the necromancer is kissing her hand.
Yeah.
So Hera touches Gideon, and Gideon's like, no.
Yes.
Weird.
And then it gets suddenly so much worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about the multi-death theory here, and we've talked about Gideon's relationship to pain. And this is, this writing takes its time to truly, lengthily, slowly, in-depthly articulate the suffering that Gideon is experiencing.
And it stands out so much more given that we do not get any other really descriptions of Gideon being in pain. Like, this is unusual for a character who's been in a lot of painful situations.
She described being in pain in the previous chamber mm-hmm. when Hera was in her brain. That was painful, but not nearly to this level.
Yeah.
And it was painful in a very different way. Like, it was painful in like a disorienting sensory kind of way. This becomes very embodied. It's like, there's like bones and like jaw, and like there's all these parts of her body, like down her left arm. Like, it gets so specific and precise in ways that the last chamber was a lot more of a like feely type of pain.
I think when she got siphoned a little bit, there was some of that. which makes sense because it's the same kind of pain. Mm-hmm. I think it was described as like a migraine in your teeth, yeah, which that's a real bodily kind of pain.
Oh, yeah.
But this is just everywhere all at once and overwhelming, and the sort of electric pain, and the imagery of as if Haro had tied a rope to all of her pain receptors and was rappelling down a very long drop.
Mm-hmm.
Evocative.
And it takes a really long time. Like, and I'm like a pretty quick reader. I just like kind of breeze through stuff. Something about this really kind of slows you down. And it's a very long passage in a way that kind of like emphasizes the like, this takes forever.
I would be curious if one were to kind of count the amount of time and that something in world would take versus the amount of pages mm-hmm. that it would take. I would feel comfortable saying that this is the shortest amount of time for the most amount of pages that we've seen so far.
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is described moment by moment in excruciating detail.
Yeah, in the previous few chapters, you know, in the you know, post Magnus and Abigail wet laundry scene, there starts with this time dilation. Writing starts to appear more and more. But this is like. We're getting little flecks of you know, a different timeline when, like, we get some speech from Dulcinea. But then we get, and it's, like, one line. And then it's a whole paragraph of just, like, here's another excruciating way that Gideon is feeling pain and is, like, losing touch with reality mm-hmm. and being a person.
I would love to know, like, what the actual, like, time it is that this would take. Like 100 meter, that's like football field ish. You gotta think she's moving pretty fast, and then she's gotta figure out a puzzle with the key, and then she's gotta sprint back.
So it does sound like she's walking a little bit slowly because she's having to push through the pain, but then she does.
Yeah.
It takes approximately 2 to 3 minutes to slowly walk 100 meters.
Okay. That's a long time if you're gonna die in 3 seconds otherwise.
Yeah, and if Palamedes is right that you can survive this for 3 minutes, that's not quite enough time. The average person can run.
Palamedes said 3 seconds.
Oh, he said 3 seconds.
I believe. Yeah.
The average person can run 100 meters in maybe 20 seconds,
mm-hmm.
which we know that the average necromancer is not as fast as the average regular person.
Yeah.
So her sprinting back, I don't know. But on the outside, this is definitely less than 10 minutes.
And there's also like stages of this as well that mm-hmm. I would be very curious how they map to like the stages of someone's body shutting down during death.
Yeah.
Because there's a wet stage and then there's a dry stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that was probably researched in the course of this, I would guess.
It feels very specific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the language feels very like there is like, you know, things are starting to disintegrate in terms of like integrity of keeping the moisture inside your body.
Mm-hmm.
And this continues until you reach a point of existing in a state of dehydration that is like a core part of your sensory experience. You're like, all of my wet is oozing out. Mm-hmm. And now I am made of dry.
And not being so able dry to see feels like a very distinct phase as well.
The idea of the blood transfusion feel of loss is a really, really interesting construction because it tells us something about how Gideon has understood or experienced blood transfusion.
From the donor direction, yeah.
It takes a lot of blood loss before you feel it like that. Mm-hmm. And receiving a blood transfusion feels amazing. If you need a blood transfusion, getting a bunch of blood feels like becoming a superhero.
Who do you think she gave her blood to?
That's a great question.
Probably just fucking anybody that needed it.
That's what I would guess.
Mm.
She was just a healthy person with blood inside.
Oof.
Bang!
I feel like a lot of the body horror in Fury Road matches up pretty well to the body horror in TLT. That's interesting. It's a lot of like being made into a tool.
Yeah, that is V is a feminist writer, best known for the Vagina Monologues, and Ooh. Was heavily involved with the development of Mad Max Fury Road. And so the feminist propaganda of that film is deeply intentional and highly like purposeful and careful in its construction.
That movie absolutely blew my mind when I saw it.
It was so fucking good. Yeah. So what I want is for Gideon to shoot someone with a big gun while writing "We Are Not Things" on the wall.
That sounds very good to me. That seems satisfying.
The crossover we need.
Yeah. Somebody, I wonder if anybody's done a Fury Road TLT crossover or fic. Probably. There's a lot of fic out there.
In this episode's edition of "We Will Genuinely Give You Money If You Make This Art for Us," Silas Octakizaron Warboy Edition. The color language in Gideon's experience of pain is really, really interesting. The sort of gray and gold and then just gray as she's kind of going through these stages.
As she's dying.
She's for sure dying.
Does this line up with them going into the river? I wonder. I want to read the scene of them driving through the river in Nona and see if some of the language and description lines up with this of her dying, because it should, I think.
That's an interesting question.
I wonder if it does.
So as she is dying and suffering, and this goes on for three solid pages and then some on either side. This is, as you said, so long. Harrow stumbles. And I remember in first reading, this was maybe the most scared I had been so far.
Yeah. Yeah. The tension in the scene is very intense.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting that we don't, and we never really get any details about what Harrow's experience of this is. We don't know why she stumbled. We don't know what the puzzle was that she had to figure out to get the key out of the box. It's just something that's happening, and we are all in Gideon's POV, which, you know, we are all the time, obviously, but I feel like this is one of the more obvious points of, like, we have no idea what's going on outside of Gideon is dying.
Yeah, they don't debrief this on Harrow's side.
Yeah.
I don't think Gideon probably was super curious about, but I took like the slowness of her moving, given the stakes, how slow she's walking for most of this. And then the fact that she stumbled tells me that it is hurting the whole time for her as well. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear how bad. And it seems like it can't be as bad because Gideon is literally screaming without meaning to. And like, you couldn't probably walk in that situation, but it seems like this was also a really, really bad experience for Harrow.
I feel like I could see it being physically painful for Harrow, or I could see it being requiring great concentration also as an alternative, or like at some point Cytherea like covers Gideon's mouth because she's like, she has to concentrate. I could also see it being like, she can hear Gideon screaming over there and it's like fucking with her brain and she's like panicking.
Or I think all of them. Yeah. All of them for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, knowing that we've led to Harrow's stumble with like 2.5 pages of excruciating detail about pain. So it really sets up that tension. And yeah, that question of like, of why.
And when Harrow stumbles, Gideon kind of like pushes a little bit more juice to her too, which might have helped her like go faster after. I don't know.
Why do you think that Cytherea was worried that Harrow would break the key?
It's got to be something about the puzzle, right?
What
like there's something
what
that maybe Cytherea requires.
Know about the puzzle?
Yeah. I mean, she was there when it was created.
Oh, Cytherea. I think Cytherea could tell anyone anything that they wanted to know about the puzzle, but she couldn't share the information about how to solve the puzzle box without explaining how she knows that.
Yeah, because she can't have been over there to look at it unless maybe somebody showed it to her when they were making it before they put it over on the other side. Yeah.
So I think this continues to enforce the theory that like this is a very anxiety inducing experience for Cytherea. Like that is more of a tell than maybe she's offered so far at all in terms of like how the fuck would she know? Why would she be worrying about that?
Or maybe that's something that as they were developing the test, people kept breaking the keys when they were testing out the puzzle.
Or maybe Mercy told her that the puzzle is designed to be virtually unwinnable. So yeah. Even if you get all the way across, you're just going to fuck it up again anyway.
Yeah. Which is so mean. Come on, Mercy.
I mean, it's not mean. It's like insurance.
True.
I'm really tempted by the explanation that this is rebellion.
Yeah. It makes sense because this is like so impossible. It's crazy. If your goal is for people to succeed at this, this is a bad test. Or if your goal is for people to learn from this, it's a terrible test.
Unless you're teaching the calf.
Yeah. To fucking leave and never look back.
Yeah.
Hey, have you ever seriously thought about the fact that your best friend is willing to eat you? Mm-hmm. Maybe you should sit with that for a minute.
Or
let me give you like 3 to 5 minutes of excruciating pain to sit with that.
Of a preview of what your entire rest of existence might be.
And I think there's actually a little bit of oscillation that happens here because we see it escalate because at some point she's identifying the voice as Dulcinea's and at some point she loses even that.
Yes.
It's really,
and then
it does.
She comes back.
It does kind of have like a little bit of a childbirth feel to me, which is funny because it is very much like waves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think also the sense of time is also parallel to childbirth experiences as well. Mm-hmm. The way that people support people during arcs of pain like this has been researched in really interesting ways, like where the emphasis is put in terms of the support changes the memory.
Mm. Next time I attend a birth, I'm just going to hold their hand and be like, remember this and don't let anyone do this to you ever again.
It's decent advice, honestly.
As the test proceeds, Kithareya is cradling Gideon and talking through this with her. And the things that she says are a little chaotic. And it's really hard to read what the fuck she's trying to accomplish in this scene. And I found myself going back and forth as I was reading between like, oh, see, she's trying to get them killed. She's trying to get Gideon killed. She's trying to get Harrow killed. This is a way of knocking out her opponent. And then I was like, one line later, like, no, she's trying to get the key. She really wants the key.
I don't
know
she
what
was
she's
trying,
doing.
I think she was trying very hard to keep Gideon alive. And I personally can't decide if that's because she does genuinely feel a lot of guilt over various terrible things that she's participated in, or if it was simply because she wanted the key and she couldn't get it without this working, or maybe a little bit of both. I don't know. You know, is this guilt over what was currently happening to Gideon? Was this guilt over what she knew she was going to do to everybody here, or guilt over the fifth, or guilt over her own cavalier? Like, because I do think she probably could not get it on her own.
I do think that that's true. And I wonder if she isn't genuinely going back and forth a little bit internally. If there are moments where she's saying, you know, you could just die. You could just die. And then immediately is like, but don't. You could, it would be so easy, but don't.
I imagine, you know, the last time that she was familiar with this room was kind of during an intense time in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And being back here and seeing this happen and seeing it happen to literal children would not waver her conviction, but would bring up a lot of complicated feelings. And for her to retain that initial motivation that brought her here to the first, while also like trying to, like, that is a complex set of motivations and feelings to navigate. Like, it makes sense that she would be oscillating wildly.
Yeah.
Like, even like some of the things mean, like we've touched on like 3 different pieces of like genuine concern and compassion for Gideon, a desire to convey the fact that she doesn't have to do this, and then needing to fulfill her own goals. And some of these things mean more than one of these things at once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see this both making her feel terrible about a lot of things and also strengthening her resolve to fight God about it.
Yeah.
Like, this is terrible.
Yeah. The moment where she says, I'm so sorry, this is all my fault, I'm so sorry. You know, it's easy to read that as because she asked them to do it, like very straightforwardly. But like, no, this is all her fault.
Mm-hmm.
How is this all her fault if this was Mercy's test?
Because
it's she not was, all her it was fault, a team but she project. Was, yeah, she was okay, yeah. part of creating it, I think is.
Yeah, the thing that where that the team project bit to me is like, we take so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not me, we, the necromancers, it's we, me, the lictor.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we is really capacious. It has we, the necromancers. It has we, the lictors. It has we, the empire. It has we, the first house. It has sort of all of that at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if Kithareya knew the purpose of this test to some degree, which is Mercy Morn, this is her fail safe, which is that everyone will fail, so everyone's safe.
Well, and half of them are.
Yeah.
Except if your calf dies, you do also die.
Yeah.
So the calves are safe. She tried to get Sextus to do this because she knew it would kill them. She would have tried to get Eighth to do this because she knew it would kill them. So
and she would have gotten Magnus and Abigail to do it.
But it would like.
But it wasn't necessary.
So she had suspicions that Gideon was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And she went into this hoping they would die.
Maybe. Or did she want the key?
I think she wanted the key.
Why didn't she ask them first? I don't understand why Kithareya would just like neg Hera by being like, actually, you were my fourth pick.
To be fair, the Sextus thing is the reason that Hera did it. So it could be that she's true. Good enough she's at manipulating them people that each other. Yeah, it could
that
be that she
makes
knew.
Sense to me because it's like if Kithareya knew the nature of this test, then she knew the odds of their survival. And if the odds of survival of anybody else here were what they were, the only ones that she'd be interested in asking were these. But yeah, I could see her playing off Hera's competitiveness to try and use like Sextus as leverage.
What if her plan is different than the plan we think?
Absolutely possible.
What if some people becoming lictors is actually part of her plan?
And she wants them to rebel like her?
She wants certain people to make it through the challenge and certain people not to. And that's there was nuanced. Something about Magnus and Abigail that she didn't think that they were going to be good rebels.
I could see that. Maybe she wanted the young ones. Although she sure did kill the fourth.
She did kill the fourth.
Pretty directly.
So she didn't want the fourth.
No. The fourth and the fifth seem the most loyal to Empire. Or, you know, among the most loyal to Empire. So that could be the thought process. And the second, I guess.
And the third.
The eighth. So maybe just the sixth and the ninth. So it is confirmed in the next chapter that she did indeed ask the sixth about it. Like, that was true.
Yeah.
And Palamedes did the calculations, and he knew that they couldn't do it.
So she wanted them dead.
Interesting.
Because then she's just using Mercy Morn's tool as a murder machine.
Yeah.
And then she doesn't look like she's murdered anyone.
If that's the case, why didn't she do that with Magnus and Abigail?
Mm-hmm. Maybe it just wasn't necessary. Maybe she just had the opportunity to sneak up on them and push them down the hatch, and that was easy.
This is a more complicated and higher risk strategy than just murdering them and pushing them down a hatch.
Yes. This feels like maybe information gathering also.
Yeah, so if maybe she's clocked that something's weird about Gideon and something's weird about Harrow, putting them through this really weird test that normal people should not survive would be fascinating.
And she said she wished she knew more about Palamedes, so maybe there's something that she wants to learn about the sixth as well. And the thing about Palamedes calculating that they couldn't do it, it was that he could do it, but with permanent brain damage to Camilla. So to Cytherea, maybe that's like, okay, well, they could do it.
It is also possible that there's an amount of information about the test that Kithareya purposely misrepresented or hid from Palamedes so that his calculations would be wrong.
True. Also, because it could still be just the playing him and Harrow against each other thing for whatever reason.
It would be difficult to ask somebody for something in order for them to say no to it so that you could play that off of somebody else. But you
She's
could 10,000
years old.
If she gave him information about the puzzle that led him to an incorrect calculation that was hopeless, he would have to refuse.
Now, we have it identified early on that his warden training included being able to identify when he was being given bad data.
Ooh.
At least some of the time. Yeah. Harrow says to Gideon afterwards that she did not receive full information from Kithareya. Kithareya misrepresented the test to her. So it seems likely that she also misrepresented the test to Palamedes. Maybe in the same way, maybe in a different way.
Do we know in what way?
She undersold how bad it would be.
Mm. Okay, so is that why? Because I felt it was very notable that Harrow was like more anti-Dulcy after the test. So that kind of makes sense. She's like, oh, you like set us up.
Yeah. Yeah. When she's like, this is none of your business. You need to fuck off. The field was vicious, much more so than Septimus communicated.
Mm-hmm.
I had to refine on the fly. So Harrow only got through this because she figured out a secret ingredient that she had not been warned about.
Which is probably part of the going slow initially bit of it.
It seems interesting that having been offered a safer than true version of the story, I think Palamedes wasn't told the same thing.
Probably. So maybe she was just straight up trying to kill them. I'm confused by her motivations.
And I think maybe her motivations are in fact conflicted.
That's very possible. And maybe it's the sort of thing where, like, if they die, that checks them off the list. If they don't die, I get the key.
Mm-hmm.
Win-win.
And information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Setting up a trial so that she gets something that she wants out of it either way does seem like a 10,000-year-old smart girl trick.
Yes.
Yeah. Because goodness knows she'll have more opportunities to murder them to come.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. So many.
And if she thought that, you know, if we think that Palamedes' calculations were accurate, then maybe she thinks that what she's doing is nerfing Gideon and turning Gideon into just a battery.
That's a good point.
It is possible that one of the outcomes she imagined from this was giving God his unexpected child severely cognitively damaged.
Which I would imagine she would take great satisfaction in.
So I think that Gideon dies in this scene. I think that this is the first, like, for sure, she dies in front of us. And my evidence is it says that in the text.
Yeah. It just tells us that. No, I am like all on board the multi-death theory. I think it makes so much sense in this. Like, if anything is a death, this is a death for sure, I think.
I didn't know about the multi-death theory until we started recording this podcast. And this fucking writing confused me so much. I was like, wait, what? But it contextualizes her relationship with pain. It contextualizes her relationship with permanence. It contextualizes her relationship with her body. It makes so many things make more sense when, like, her experience is that she doesn't know that she has died many times before. Mm-hmm. She just thinks this is normal because she's literally never had any contrasting experience.
Also, she says it felt a hell of a lot like dying, which kind of suggests that she knows what dying feels like, so.
Sometimes your body tells you that you're dying.
That's true.
A lot of people who are at the end of their life know that they're dying, know that they're about to die. When the dying process happens more slowly, people often are able to communicate that they know that they're dying. And sometimes when something is really, really wrong in your body, the thing that your body tells you is you are dying. And I have had that, and it is weird because it's not, I feel so bad that I think logically that I might die. It is, I feel like I'm dying. Mm-hmm. It's an instinctive feeling.
And for me, like, doom.
Yeah.
I have also had that.
Impending doom is a real symptom.
That also seems like something that, if you haven't experienced it, the language "you feel like you're dying" lacks it. Like, I'm like, as someone who, I'm pretty sure I haven't experienced that, I'm like,
you know,
yeah, not as punchy.
No, yeah, I'm like, that language is so unadorned.
Yeah, no, uh-huh. It feels like that. It feels like you're dying. The thing that you receive in the command center, a note that says you're dying.
So Hero, like in the little excerpt, you're making yourself an utter fool over Dulcinea, italicized in a way that's sarcastic. And then later on, as they're leaving, she asks Dulce, why did you want to be a lictor? Which to me, the phrasing of that in this context is, why do you want to be a lictor?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Do we think that Hero suspected at least that Dulce was not who she said she was? I think yes. But like, did she think she was a lictor?
I don't know. It is a weird way to ask that question.
Yes.
And the way that Dulcinea answers it, Kitherea answers it, works.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all, the past tense is weird for both of them.
Yeah.
If you imagine that they're both in the lictor process now.
And I could see this being something that Tamsin's putting in there as like a fun little nod. But like in universe, I'm like, why would you say it like that?
There's also a moment at the beginning as they're coming into the chamber with Dulcinea and Protessa Lawis where Gideon makes a note that Hero, oddly, hurries away from her in order to chat with Protessa Lawis.
Yes.
So Hero is definitely investigating him. And, you know, Hero has quite a bit of experience puppeting. For sure she's clocked this by now.
Yes. I think that she definitely figured that out at this point.
So she knows that Dulcinea is lying about at least some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure she's remembering the discrepancy on arrival and going, okay, the discrepancy is this is not a guy.
There's not two souls on board this aircraft.
You have the wrong number of living people. So I think that would make anyone very reasonably suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as you sort of foreshadowed at the end of this chapter, Hera was like, pretty concerned about Gideon's self-respect and is like, we need to reassess this.
Yeah.
You should care that you just almost died.
She's very mad. Which I feel like this is definitely also another like pretty significant shift in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I would counterpoint with the same one I did before. If Hero doesn't have Gideon, Harrow's not going to get through these trials.
That's true.
She needs Gideon. And if Gideon gets herself fucking killed, Gideon has fucked up the plan.
Yeah. She has a personal stake in Gideon having self-preservation. That's true.
And there is, I absolutely agree, a degree of tenderness to both aspects at the beginning and end of this chapter around Harrow's care towards Gideon. And I don't think that is not part of it, but that is not enough in Harrowhark Nonagesimus to justify this degree of changed behavior.
I think that's very true.
So Hera's having some real conflicted feelings about the thing that she just did.
Oh, yeah.
She regrets it, but also feels like she isn't free to choose to do anything but continue to commit these necromantic sins that she's up to.
This feels like a big time sunk cost fallacy situation where like, well, if I've done this, let's not make it all for nothing sort of situation.
And yeah. I think that's kind of how she relates to her existence.
True. Yeah. The 200 ghosts. Yeah. I think her bare face after this is definitely, that feels symbolic to me of exposure and vulnerability and such.
I mean, not just bare face, the girl's stark ass naked.
Uh-huh.
Like, for sure, vulnerability and, like, truthfulness. And I think there's also this, like, peeling back the formality and the protocol that allows her own thoughts to come through and her own personality to come through in a way that like she is questioning, not just like she regrets what she's done, but I think you start to see her realizing her position within this whole larger structure. she's having to negotiate her relationship with Septimus and Protesilaus, and like the ways in which she's having to negotiate power with the other houses is starting to affect her more. Like, there's just, she's realizing that Gideon is really her only actual safe ally in this. And I think that's maybe a position of care, that like the vulnerability is like, oh, we're in this together and we can't trust anyone else.
Yeah, I feel like she's exposed above all else to herself.
Yeah.
At the end of this, like so we talked a little bit about like she's seeing her belief systems and kind of doubling down rather than like questioning them with the like, let's prove it to Sextus thing. I feel like maybe this is the start of like, are we the baddies? Like, oh God, what are we doing sort of thing?
Yeah. And I think of maybe when I'm in that, like, I don't have the luxury, like I have to do this thing. Like often when I'm in that logic, I'm at the precipice of breaking myself.
Yes.
This is when like I hit the wall and I have to admit that the way that I'm going here needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
I think also she came into this chapter already clearly suspicious about Dulcinea. And then the fact that Dulcinea hid information from her that almost got Gideon killed, and Gideon is being blasé about it, has her a little bit panicked, because she's like, Gideon is fundamentally not understanding how dangerous this woman is and is mm-hmm. not going to start understanding.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's got to be frustrating.
Frustrating and like, you know, terrifying. Like if Gideon falls to Dulcinea or Kithareia, so does Hera.
Also, I want to point out how this experience for Hera is bound up with romantic jealousy. And when you love someone who is into somebody who is harmful for them, that's really hard to navigate, because it's really hard to pick out which parts of this are just pettiness, which parts mm-hmm. of this are just jealousy, which parts of this are real. And like, okay, even if it is real, how do I protect them when they're in it? When they're
you
into
can never
it, like,
make them see it. That's not how it works.
That's not how it works.
Han, can you speak to having that experience at all?
While Claire and I were dating, and really quite early in our relationship, Claire started a relationship with another person that was fiery and enthusiastic and passionate in a way that wasn't in our relationship in the same way. And that was really challenging. And then there started to be these signs that something wasn't right. And I knew that I was jealous. And so I was like, well, is it just that? Like, and if it's not, then what?
That's so rough.
We ended up having some really productive conversations after Claire got herself out of that situation by herself, about like, well, how do you handle this? And I had conversations also with Hannah about the same time, because I was with Hannah then as well, about like, okay, well, what happens if this happens again? Because, you know, if you're not monogamous and you keep forming new relationships, some of them will suck.
Yeah. And what's your degree of responsibility in that situation?
And one of the things that we all sort of learned from that is an abusive relationship doesn't just happen to a person. It happens to a community.
Mm.
And a few years later, I got into an abusive relationship and I was able to get out of it pretty quickly. And part of that was because we kind of had more tools by then about how to respond, and also like how to keep yourself safe from someone else's abuser.
And I think that's where like a framework of looking at community and relationships as ecosystems started to emerge. Like,
yeah.
And to like pull it back into the podcast language, like when you look at the isolation that Hera and Gideon are experiencing here, and the fact that these consequences only really affect each other, they don't have a larger set of people to contextualize, you know, if Kithareia is playing the different people against each other, she may be the only one who has a larger sense of context. You know, Magnus and Abigail may have been, like, I still think partially a threat because they showed promise of creating social unity, creating a social ecosystem in which they could evaluate the consequences of the position that they were in here on the first.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that wouldn't have happened if people were just communicating.
Yes, absolutely. And if Gideon had had a friend who didn't have a crush on her, who loved her, who she could trust, who could say, hey, I know that this lady looks at you real sweet. This lady is not sweet.
Mm-hmm.
That would have changed things for her. But she already has this tension with Harrow. And so when Harrow's like, I don't like when she looks at you like that, she's like, well, I don't like when she looks at you like that.
Yeah. They're two children without a larger supportive environment. And we're seeing so many things happen to them because there's no sounding board for them to realize that this isn't a normal thing.
Yeah.
Like, I think the only way we first start seeing that is in Gideon's relationship with Magnus, where mm-hmm. she's like, wait, what? You people just are like just nice to each other?
And also, Isaac doesn't have anyone to tell him that his relationship is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean-Marie doesn't have anyone to tell her that her relationship is not okay.
Yeah.
Everybody's so fucked up.
Everybody's so fucked up.
So fucked up.
The subtitle of the series.
The Locked Tomb. Everybody's so fucked up.
Yeah.
I have so much to say about just like everything in this book. And I appreciate that y'all have given me a vehicle to do so a little bit.
You are welcome to come yap with us literally anytime. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art features our guest, Caro, as Kithereya, as Dulcinea. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's nunpod.com. And remember to check the episode notes. There's stuff in there. Thanks for listening.